This is a download from the Post Keynesian Economics Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net.
Well, welcome to the Keynes Seminar once again. My pleasure tonight is to introduce two speakers, Dr. Toralf Pusch, who will talk about measuring the multiplier within the EU, followed by a response from Dr. Pontus Rendaur. Toralf Pusch is a member of a research group working on institutional convergence and national development in Central and Eastern Europe at the Halle Institute for Economic Research in Germany. The paper he's going to present tonight has been published in Intervention, the European Journal of Economics and Economic Policies, but this is not at present too readily visible, this journal, but that will change next year when it becomes EJEEP. EJEEP. Does this mean no intervention? I don't know. But with Edward Elgar as the new publisher, so hopefully that will give it more visibility. Pontus Rendaur is lecturer here in the Faculty of Economics and specialises in macroeconomic theory. I know that he's been working hard to find a role for traditional insights about the fiscal multiplier within the framework of mainstream theory. And I do hope, actually, that this discussion, which is obviously focused on the empirical data, and will provide important common ground with post-Keynesian economics, despite the different methodologies of the two approaches. And Pontus has kindly agreed to give us the initial response to Toralf's talk to set our discussion going. So, over to you, Toralf.
Well, thanks for the invitation and for the introduction, Mark, and it's for me a pleasure to be here, to speak here about the paper, about fiscal multipliers within Europe. Actually, it's not just the Eurozone. I have also other countries involved. As sad as it is, the UK doesn't supply an input-output table, so I couldn't calculate fiscal spending multiplier based on that method for the UK. I don't know if the data are somewhere available, but it seems like it's not supplied to Eurostat. So, as I mentioned, the whole presentation goes about the effects of fiscal spending and fiscal spending multipliers on the economy. And of course, there are some novel aspects, or what I would say is there are novel aspects in this paper. And of course, there are also other ways of fiscal spending multiplier calculation. This is a very old topic, as you all know, and I will give some literature background also in the course of the presentation. And here, this is my outline. So I start with an introduction into the topic, what inspired me for this research, and what is this technique about, this input-output analysis technique? What interesting research questions can be answered with it? Second, I give a little background information about empirical multiplier estimates. There's, of course, a vast literature about this, and especially in the recent years, it has expanded after the financial crisis. And my way of calculating the multipliers then presented in the third section by means of input-output analysis. So I give a little introduction in this technique. And then I present some example calculations for large economies in Europe where I could find the data for every single year up to 2008. And these are figures for Germany and France. I found that quite interesting because these two economies are quite comparable in size, economic weight, and they make up about half of the economic weight of the Eurozone. So these are really, really important countries when fiscal consolidation is concerned and when the effects are topical. I present some figures here about a very conventional view on the topic, the so-called textbook multiplier. There are some drawbacks to this calculation methods, and that's actually one of the novelties of this paper. Even though the knowledge is older, but I tackle the question with input-output analysis. So the input-output analysis enables to have a more detailed view on fiscal spending multipliers. So you can have a look on different spending categories, and you can sort out some effects which might blur or might hinder a proper calculation of spending multipliers, especially in times when the international integration of trade is still expanding. And we are now in a very integrated world, and as it seems, or as my calculations show, this shows up especially in the category of exported goods, and this has important effects for fiscal spending multipliers. So I present figures for this textbook multiplier and compare to a general government spending multiplier, excluding exports, that is very important. And then I go more into detail and I relax the assumptions. So I have a look on special items of government spending, like government consumption, very important, makes up the largest part of government spending. So spending for wages of employees, staff in public administration, at the universities and elsewhere. Then I have a look at government spending on construction, which is also important, of course, especially if we talk about fiscal spending during downturns, because much is done then usually by means of spurring investment, public investment, large parts of which are construction works. And lastly, I will also have a look on the spending on welfare, public spending on welfare, which is also, of course, quite important if we have a look on European economies. And all these figures are presented for Germany and France to have a comparable economies. Have a look on the results. Do they differ? Are they comparable? And actually, some people might assume that Germany is much more internationally integrated. That is true to some extent. But what I've seen is that the fiscal spending multipliers don't differ much from the French ones. Very interesting result. So this is all done in the fourth section. And lastly, I will also present some multipliers for other EU member states for one single year, so to have one slice in the time, 2005. And then some comparisons can be made, and interesting results can also be shown then. So I start here with the introduction. I already introduced it quite a bit, but what were my inspirations? At first, I read an article of two researchers at my institute, Udo Ludwig and Hans-Ulrich Brautsch. They wrote it in 2008, and the article was a reaction to the bizarre economy debate in Germany. Maybe some of you have heard, but probably it's more a German topic. So this debate was launched by IFO head Hans-Werner Sinn, and he actually asserted that the German success in exports is not really a success story, but actually it's a story of demise. He said what German industry is doing is actually just importing parts from cheap production networks in Asia or Eastern Europe, put it together, brand it, then put it to the world market. That's the bazaar part of it, of the economy. And of course, he had a certain intention. He wanted to push for more liberal labor markets to really make it a success story. This was just to, in a way, to deconstruct the success. And what Ludwig and Brautsch did, they had a look at the data. What do the data say? Is this really true, is what Mr. Sinn is here saying? And what they found out is it's a bit of a nonsense. Only 40% of the value added, or 40% of the product value of exported goods is represented, or is import intake, 40%. So the majority of production is actually done in Germany. Interesting result. But still, of course, the 40% are quite a large number. And the normal figure, I think, for the German import quota is about 30%, I think, when I studied. And you see there's a higher import intake in the export industries. That's an interesting finding. And if you now consider the usual textbook spending multiplier, which is still present in some macroeconomic textbooks, there you have a marginal import quota, or sometimes also not marginal, gross import quota. And yeah, if you have so differing quotas of imports of different demand categories, you can have biased multiplier estimates. And that strand actually was taken up by two rather recent studies of Lasky et al. These were Polish researchers, and Thomas Pelly from the United States. They were referring actually to older studies, especially Pelly does, and he says that this knowledge that you should actually disentangle the imports necessary for the production of different demand categories is actually old knowledge, but it has fallen off the shelves over time. Mm-hmm. So you don't find it no more in textbooks. And what he did then, and the Polish researchers as well, they did back of the envelope calculations in their articles using data they got from the macroeconomic accounts in order to arrive at better estimates of the fiscal spending multiplier, the one for the US and the other for the Polish economy. That I found quite interesting. And then I remembered the other article of the researchers at my institute, and I thought, yeah, that's the data set. This data set should be used to disentangle it, because again, what Pelle and Lasky et al. Were doing, they were just using rather macro data, which are not so detailed. And it can be done, the disentangling procedure can be done much more accurate using input-output calculus. So I put actually the both ideas together to calculate my fiscal spending multipliers. And of course, another inspiration for me has been a general comeback of fiscal policy after the world financial crisis, with a huge literature now booming in this field, and all the people doing DSG models and the like. And so I thought this might be interesting to have also a look at the fiscal spending multiplier from this perspective, because it has some advantages also. So now some words about the input-output analysis, also for the introductory purpose, because it is quite an old technique. It has developed already in the 1940s by Vasily Leontiev, a Russian-born researcher who went to the United States, and it was his research was in a way part of planning efforts in the US during World War II, because there were some big questions to be tackled or to be judged. How are the effects of demobilization and decreases of war spending after the end of the war? Remember, in the 40s, during the Second World War, it was so that private consumption only made up 40% of American GDP. So you can imagine how much production was actually devoted to military spending and military buildup. And the natural question then is, of course, this war is going to end somewhere, and what is going to happen to the economy? Might there be another blow at the economy if war spending is withdrawn? And this was a very interesting question for the government, and also then that was the reason why there were research projects set up by the government, by government agencies, also, for example, by the Air Force even. And input-output calculus was used to this end, and it was developed in the first place. This was also even involving the first large-scale commercial electromechanical computer manufactured by IBM. So quite some connections can be drawn. And you know, this was later a success story, IBM, and maybe a bit spurred by input-output analysis. Today, input-output analysis is applied by researchers around the world, especially in Asia and the Netherlands, but not only there. And so there are a lot of research groups. Also at my institute, there's a little research group of people who are interested in this kind of research. And examples of applications are analysis of sectoral policies, like, for example, R&D spending of the government during downturns. That has been a research project by my institute. It was a research project for the government during the financial crisis. And tax policy issues, regional policy issues can also be tackled with this technique. Now, I would like to give you some background information about empirical multiplier estimates. I'm sure that the second referee is more an expert in this field. I was mainly concentrating on the old strands of the theory and some empirical stuff. And here I would like to mention, for example, Samuelson, who first brought the textbook Fiscal Spending Multiplier into the debate, and then later on Hansen, who wrote a very successful macroeconomic textbook, which was used for a very long time. Yeah. So that is quite important. And it was also popularized in a certain way, this concept. So it goes back to the 1940s and 1950s. And recently, I would like to mention new Keynesian studies. There are a lot of them. They have a theoretical focus or an empirical focus. Much of work, of course, is done now empirical. And also, I already mentioned two post-Keynesian studies, which are theoretical and empirical, but more back-of-the-envelope calculations. It can be done with more data, what I want to do now. And what I found, and I also read, I found it quite interesting to have a look on a recent Journal of Economic Literature issue on this topic, fiscal spending multiplier calculations, this literature. What I found there was two main arguments mentioned, two drawbacks in many, many studies. The first one is a linear approximation of fiscal spending multipliers. They are considered the same in booms as in downturns, which is unrealistic, of course, for a number of reasons. I don't have to maybe explain very much to post-Keynesians. If there's slack in the economy, probably fiscal spending has a higher effect because there's ample capacity in the industry. So output can be expanded quite easily. And this is the general argument. The argument can be found to a certain extent also in the new Keynesian studies of rather newer time, with a zero lower bound literature. That's also mentioned in these JEL contributions, but it's not so general. So it only sets in at a certain time point when monetary policy is ineffective. But I think, to my mind, the more general view would be to really generalize the two normal economic times, two normal booms and downturns even. And what is interesting, you will see that in the calculations, you can really see the pattern of the moving multiplier during the business cycle using this method. And so this is the first problem I would like to mention, and it is found in the literature there in these contributions. And the second problem in many studies is that they use macro data only, and only implicitly then the production structure of the economy is reflected. For example, I mentioned the problem with the import intake of exports. That is, of course, to some extent, it is reflected if you do empirical estimations. You have elasticities, and it is in the models, but it is not, it is not done, for example, on a year-by-year base. And also, the production structure of the economy is changing over time. You can see that clearly from the input-output tables. What you can do now with econometrics is to have a look at time series. Underlying the assumption is widespread that the economy, the structure of the economy stays broadly the same, and then you can, of course, do your estimations. And here, input-output calculus is much more general. So you can take a look, have a look on the economy at certain time points. The structure is reflected in the table. That's very interesting in my point of view. So, that was a bit about the background of empirical multiplier estimates and what could be done else. And this is now what I do, the input-output calculation of the multiplier. My concept goes back now to the concept of Samuelson, the well-known old textbook fiscal spending multiplier. I have here a formula, dy over dg, so the derivation of output. And this is 1 over 1 minus C plus M. And C stands for a marginal consumption parameter, so the marginal consumption of households if income is raised or if spending is raised by the government, what is consumed out of this increased spending. And M, the small m, stands for an import quota, also a marginal quota in the textbook concept usually. And all of this derives from familiar accounting identity of gross domestic product accounting. You can write the formula and then derive it. And you have to insert, of course, certain assumptions here, a constant quota of consumption and a constant quota of imports out of this different spending categories, and then you can make this derivation. So this is the old concept. As I already mentioned, there might be some flaws if the production structure of the economy is a bit unequal. So if, for example, export goods are manufactured in a way which is very much internationally integrated, and if you have a look on the input-output tables, you actually see that. We actually see that in certain sectors of the economy, a very high intake of imports is going on, for example, in investment goods, also in parts of exports, for example. Exports are very import-intensive, so there are huge international production networks, highly integrated. And if now the assumption is made that the import quota is the same over all components of final demand, that is somewhat flawed. And what can help here is input-output calculus. I have here for you, in the slides you can see it, there is a matrix structure of the economy on the left-hand side. You can see A values, these are the input-output coefficients. The A11 stands, for example, the input of the product of sector one, it could be, for example, the steel industry, into, again, the steel industry, because of it is 1-1. It goes into the same industry. And it is often the case that the same industry delivers to some extent to itself. But, of course, much more general patterns emerge. So the steel industry delivers to the automobile industry, to another sector. So you have a look on the first row, and you can see all the sectors which use the inputs from that steel industry, for example. It could be car industry. It could be also construction in the concrete. You have to use steel, for example. And this is all reflected in the input-output matrix. That is only the left-hand side of the matrix. On the right-hand side, you have the final demand. So you have the production going on the left-hand side, what is being used, what has to be used by the industry and is not for final demand. Only at the end is for the final demand. And on the right-hand side, you really can see the D values, which then stand for consumption, like private consumption, government consumption, investment spending, also exports are there. So exported goods can be found there. Category by category, so sector by sector, automotives, steel industry, construction works, that is on the right-hand side. That is very interesting for us later on, because this information is then used to disentangle the import intake of the different industries or demand components. And there's also on the bottom of the table another important field. This is here called OC in this slide. And OC stands for other costs of production for good J in sector J, for example, if it's in the J's column. And in these other costs are included value-added items. So the value-added happening in the economy, the production actually value-added, is reflected there. Wage costs can be found there. Profits can be found there. And so I can repeat a bit maybe. On the top left side of the table, you see all the inter-sector flows, what one sector buys from the other sectors. On the bottom, you see where the value added is taking place, or how much value added is taking place. On the right-hand side, you can see the final demand components, what the product is used for at the end. This is the input-output table, and with this table, now a number of things can be done. I display it for you. I first also have to mention that there's another table, which I don't show here. This is the import matrix M, which gives impression what kind of imports are used in which industry, and also for final demand. So there's even another matrix which is also used usually in the calculations, and I also have to use it, but I don't display it here. The first step now of my input-output multiplier calculation is a very easy one. I just make one differentiation. I make the differentiation of a possibly high import intake of export goods, and probably I would assume domestic absorption, which is consists of consumption, spending, investment, and government spending. Probably this demand does not contribute much to imports, not so much at least as export spending. So this differentiation I make. I assume that the import quotas of consumption, investment, and government spending are the same. They are all conflated, these demand categories, and export spending has a different import quota. Only one differentiation. This assumption will be relaxed later on in the further multiplier calculations. And what is being done now? For the calculation of the import intake of export goods or the import intakes of domestic absorption, I found it most easily to calculate the import intakes of exported goods and then just to subtract these imports from overall imports, and then to calculate a quota. With that, I can calculate a fiscal spending multiplier of domestic absorption. That's the steps involved. And in order to arrive there at the multiplier, I first have to calculate the import intake of exports. And this is done by using the input-output table, which I just introduced to you. And it can be done in a matrix writing like here. You can see it on the slides. It might look a bit difficult, but it's actually quite straightforward. So for the production of export goods, you need some domestic production, and you have to subtract what has been used in the domestic production process as an input. And this is the first formula. And you need really the input-output table there. Yx minus A, which is the input-output table, times Yx is the production of export goods in the end. And this formula can then be reformulated, and you can get then really the domestic production necessary to produce exported goods. That's what Brautsch and Ludwig have done in their article. They have calculated that. And this domestic production necessary for the production of exported goods can then be lumped together in a sum formula. These are all nominal values, by the way. So you get a euro value then. And you have the imports necessary for the production of exported goods. And then you have to subtract this value from overall imports, and you get the value of imports which is induced by domestic absorption, so by investment, consumption, and government spending. And this value you can divide by domestic absorption, then you have an import quota of domestic absorption, and that can be inserted into some sort of textbook fiscal spending multiplier. It looks a bit different because of the derivation. I've expanded the formula a bit. As I said, it differs a bit from the conventional approach. And that's how it is done for the domestic absorption multiplier. For the other spending categories, it is done in a very similar way, only that I don't conflate the spending categories together then. For example, I calculate a import intake of private consumption, or not private consumption, that spending multiplier I haven't. I've done it for the welfare spending multiplier. There I had to do it. But for the government consumption multiplier, for example, I had to calculate the import intake of government spending in this category of government consumption. That is easily possible. And then insert it into such kind of a formula. These were the next steps. And now I can come to my calculations and present you some data for Germany and France. First, a little comparison of the old textbook fiscal spending multiplier and the DA domestic absorption multipliers for Germany and France. The figures range between, you can see, for example, for the textbook, multiplier between roughly 1.4 and, oh, it starts at 1.4 in Germany in 2000, and in 2007 it ends at 1.2. So there's quite a decrease happening over time. The maximum decrease is even 13%. Now, if argued in the paper, there might be a number of reasons for that decrease. One is, very importantly, the structure of the economy has changed. There is more globalization happening, but that is only one contributing source. Another contributing source is the business cycle, of course. The general argument, if there's slack in the economy, you can expect higher fiscal spending multipliers.
Does this suggest the opposite?
No, the slack in the economy was happening in 2003, especially. And you see in 2003, the textbook spending multiplier at 1.4. And in 2007, that was really a boom year.
Okay.
In Germany, that was...
it's very interesting.
After that is interesting. I think now the figures for 2008 are out. And I would be very interested in those figures, but I haven't done the calculations yet. But one can have a look at it easily. It's very easy to calculate it. Once you have programmed it, it's very straightforward. But another thing I wanted to explain here is that the domestic absorption concept, with this concept you can actually see what a difference it makes to disentangle the import fractions, which is not done in the usual way in the ordinary textbook multiplier, but with a DA concept you can see really a difference. So the fiscal spending multipliers there are higher here by roughly, I would say, 0.2, which is something. So the fiscal spending multipliers range quite similarly for Germany and France in the range of 1.5 to maybe even higher, 1.6 at the top. And they are much higher than the textbook spending multipliers. And the reason for that is really the different import intake of the domestic absorption as compared to the overall product of the economy. And what can be seen else is that the fluctuations, if the domestic absorption concept is used, are a bit lower than the ones of the textbook spending multiplier. I would derive this from a highly volatile, for example, export development in Germany, one thing. And of course, there's still some variation going on, and I would also expect that, as I mentioned. It's a natural thing to expect in a slack scenario, for example, that spending multipliers go up. Next, I would like to present you government consumption multipliers for consumption multipliers for the government. And again, for Germany and France, you can see here in this slide that these multipliers are even higher than the ones of domestic absorption. They are now in the range of 1.6 to 1.7 even. Still higher than the domestic absorption. And still there are some fluctuation going on. The multipliers are the highest in the slack years and the lowest in the boom years. And again, they are quite comparable for France and Germany, which is interesting because I would say many German economists would argue we cannot expand fiscal spending or find our way out of a recession by way of fiscal spending only in really rare occasions. When the financial crisis hit, then the mainstream changed a bit in Germany. Then all were again for fiscal spending. But now the course has really reversed in the economic debate. And what I find interesting here, even in Germany, you can have high fiscal spending multipliers, even though it is highly internationally integrated. And the multipliers are in the same range as the French ones. Construction spending multipliers. Here they can be seen in this slide. They also range like the government consumption spending multipliers between 1.6 and 1.8 even, so still a bit higher than government consumption multipliers. I would derive this to a really from a really low import intake of this production sector. You can see here figures of the import quota of 0.06 for Germany. That is really little. The same for France, and the volatility is still there, which is for me nice to see, the volatility of the multipliers. It's really an advantage of this technique that you can see the production structure changing. And lastly, welfare spending multipliers, which are somewhat lower, and this is due to mainly to the higher import intake of private consumption. Here I had to calculate it. And the import intake there is about 0.2 for both countries, and the multipliers range between 1.4 and 1.5 roughly. There's still some fluctuations there. Also, highest multipliers can be found in the slack year 2003 in both countries, and in 2007 they are somewhat lower, 1.4 about. Lastly, I want to show you different fiscal spending multipliers for EU member states. I have calculated it for the countries which supply the input-output tables. For example, Austria. Interesting case. Austria is a small open economy, many people would assume, but if you have a look on the textbook multiplier, you find it 1.1, the fiscal spending multiplier is 1.1. It's not so high, still more than one, so you could argue it's not nothing. It's more than nothing, but 1.1, maybe not so much damage. Damage is done by fiscal consolidation, one could assume. But if one has a look at the different spending categories, the picture changes. The public consumption multiplier, for example, is 1.57 in the year 2005, which is quite high. Surely much higher than the textbook spending multiplier. Construction works, 1.6. That's in the range of the German multipliers for a much smaller economy. Very interesting to see. And actually, that is what can be found in many EU member states, you can see here. Even very small countries like, I pick one out here, Hungary, for example. Hungary is under pressure of financial markets. Hungary has to consolidate. Hungary has a construction spending multiplier of 1.48, which is really similar to the German spending multiplier there. And you could expect high contractionary effects of fiscal consolidation under such a scenario. And under other interesting cases might be, for example, Ireland, for you here in UK. I would assume the low fiscal spending multipliers, rather low for Ireland, can be traced back to a high integration with the UK. It's probably highly integrated, the production structure of Ireland, but still you have even for Ireland public consumption multipliers of 1.27, so more than one. So there will be some effects of fiscal consolidation in Ireland, and I think that's what we see at the moment in Ireland. There's contraction going on. What might be maybe still interesting cases, I have marked here Hungary, Ireland, and Greece. Yeah, Greece is also an interesting case. Greece, for Greece, you can see really an inflated consumption quota for the year 2005. So the results for Greece are clearly driven by this high consumption quota, and one might argue now this was in a way exaggerated, too much consumption, and consumption funded by credits also. And so I would say the Greek multipliers mark here the upper margin of the multipliers, because the consumption quota has come down, I would say. But still, for Greece, you can see not just the consumption multiplier, also the import quotas play a role, and you get the largest multipliers can be seen for Greece. And from the standpoint of the year 2005, fiscal consolidation would have been really looked dangerous for Greece. If you look at these figures, for example, for public consumption, you can see there's a multiplier of 2.3, and for construction works, 2.2. So I would say this has to be looked at with caution, but still there might be quite some contractionary effects of fiscal consolidation, especially if one has a look on the import quotas. So yeah, I would like to thank you very much for your attention. This is already the end of my talk, and I look look forward for the discussion and now for the second referee. Thank you very much.
Okay, so thank you very much for thank you to Rob for your presentation, and thank you, Mark, for inviting me to present. I think it's very good that we try to keep up a good dialogue between the faculty and the various organizations of CEPRAM, so I'm very happy to be here. So this is the article is very related to textbooks, multiplier style spending, and my discussion will be related to that as well. So I've written here, this is the model we all love, maybe not all of us, but I truly appreciate it. And I mean, the first is just national accounting identity. The second is the private sector's budget constraint, in which you have disposable income on the left-hand side, you have consumption and you have savings on the right-hand side, and then the model is sort of closed by having this condition, savings is equal to investment, but of course when you have a public sector as well, as savings doesn't have to equal investment, it's also equal to whatever deficit the government is running, plus net exports. So if you tend to export more than you import, that's savings. So the way, I mean, these three equations doesn't tell you, first of all, one of them is redundant, because the second, the third together with the second imply the first. Secondly, the model is not closed in any way. We cannot get any predictions. There are too many free variables, too few equations. So we need to add equations in order to say anything economically meaningful. And the way normally this is done, and it's also done in the paper by Torolf, is that we close it by assuming some behavioral assumptions. So we make assumptions on behavior, and that will help us to squeeze out some economic meaning. I'm writing here that consumption is very stubbornly tied to current income. So consumption is the marginal propensity to consume multiplied by disposable income. It's a very important assumption in this model. It is incredibly important. Everything changes if this assumption would be violated in any way. It means that if you increase savings, so if we go back one slide, and if we increase government spending, savings by definition must increase, but households refuses to reduce consumption because income hasn't changed. In the end, that would mean, and I will get back to that, it would mean that the only free variable to actually change is output, and that's actually what's going to happen. So if we increase output, individuals increase their consumption, but not of all this domestic consumption. So part of this increase in demand would be demand for foreign goods. And that's why we have this idea that imports is some fraction of income as well. So you increase consumption, but since you also buy an iPhone, and iPhones are produced in America and Asia and whatnot, that's going to be part of the import, part of this model. So with, I'm writing here that with stubborn consumption, any increase in demand for savings, say for instance that export exogenously increases, if imports is left unchanged, that means that individuals will save more. It won't reduce consumption, so the only variable that is free to adjust is output, and then output must increase for the budget to balance. So this is the mechanism of a standard stimulating effect of government spending. If we simply combine these assumptions together with the accounting identity and the budget constraint, it will give us the famous equation that output is determined by the multiplier term plus autonomous spending, which is then investment in this case, government spending and export, and the multiplier is this 1 minus C plus M. And then we can take the partial derivatives, and we find that the fiscal multiplier is, it has this standard expression. So Torolf's paper starts from what I thought was a very interesting observation. You mentioned that it's an old idea that has sort of gotten lost over time, and I wasn't aware of it, and I read many introductory textbooks in my admittedly short career, but it's been quite a few of them. And the idea is, the observation or the idea here is that a lot of the imports that are done by a country is simply intermediate goods, and they're going to be used for the purpose of exports. So the United States, they import a tremendous amount of semiconductors, they put them in iPhones, and then they ship them out to Asia again. And these exports, the iPhones that are purchased in Asia or in the UK for that matter, it's largely driven by world demand. It's not driven by anything else. So if exports changes because of world demand, so will import demand for these particular goods. So US demand for semiconductors from Asia depends on Asian demand on US export goods, like iPhones. So this, of course, means that we would expect that a large share of imports is actually driven by exogenous forces, in particular for smaller economies. Maybe not the United States, it's a bad example, but smaller European economies, you would definitely have a situation in which a large share of imports can be driven by the demand for exports. And of course, then we would create a bias in our measurements of simply looking at the ratio of the propensity to import, sorry, the ratio of imports to output, and call that the propensity to import. It's going to create a bias because such a large share of all these imports is actually for other purposes than for consumption within the country. And since we think, I mean, it's important to tie this story together, it's important to realize that the reason we have a propensity to import to begin with is that whenever Y increases, C increases, but C contains a lot of foreign goods, so that's why imports increases. So much more, now I'm sort of simplifying your paper a little bit, I hope you don't mind too much. So I'm saying a more realistic, the two frameworks are the same in the end, by the way, a much more realistic import function would be very, very simple. We would just augment it with some sort of constant, and I'm going to call it A. So I'm going to say the total import, it depends on little m, which is the marginal propensity to import because we purchase more goods when our income goes up. But it also depends on A. And A is the amount of imports that you have for other purposes than domestic absorption or domestic consumption. It's the type of imports that you have in order to put it into your final goods that you ship out. So this is basically the distinction that is made in this paper, and it's an important observation, and I think it's valid in its interest. So now if we would take this model and we assume that this model actually provide a good and realistic description of the world, we would try to give some quantitative assessment to all these parameters in the model in order to gauge what will be the effect of government spending, for instance. So if we would do this in a little bit of a naive way and we would try to measure the propensity to import as simply the measure of imports in national accounting divided by GDP, we're going to get a bias estimate. And the bias estimate is easy to see because M, capital M over Y, so imports over GDP, is simply equal to the marginal propensity to import, but plus this exogenous component of import as a share of GDP. So the right marginal propensity to import, this little m, is going to be the standard way of measuring things, but we need to subtract a component, which is this exogenous component divided by GDP. And that's basically, we have a bias, and what Torov is doing in this paper is essentially correcting for this bias in order to get more sensible measures. So how do you do this? And this is one of the novelties of the paper, how to actually do this. So the parameter A, I write, is not really a parameter, it's a measure of the amount of, say, exogenous imports. It's a measure of imports that are used for the purpose of exports, so it's semiconductors. So total imports, and if we subtract A from total imports, that's the amount of imports that are used for domestic demand or domestic absorption. So what Torov is doing is he calculates M minus A using these Leontief-style input-output matrices, and by doing that you can correct for this bias. So in that way you can figure out what is A, you divide it by GDP, essentially you subtract it and you get a better measure of the propensity to import. I'm a little bit unfair here because what is done in the paper, I'm not sure if I'm unfair or not, it's just another way of seeing, it's the same idea. But what is done in the paper is that everything, instead of seeing this as a separate marginal propensity to import, which is immediately saying that M is actually a function of Y, I think what Turov is saying in the paper is that M is not a function of Y, it's a function of C and I plus G. Okay, but in the end, that means that if we increase output, we're going to increase consumption, which will increase import. But I'm just writing here that that means it's a, it is a causal effect from income to import, but it would go via consumption in the paper, but here I'm just establishing it directly. Mathematically, it will work out exactly the same. So I think this seems like it's so sensible that I'm surprised that it's new. Because it's, I mean, it's definitely true that a large share of what is being imported is imported for completely different reasons than standard domestic consumption, investment, and government spending. It's something very, very different. So you can see from the bias, you know exactly which way the bias is going to get. If you calculate this in the naive way, you're going to find that the marginal propensity to import is too large, so we will have to reduce it if we've done things correctly, and this is exactly what happens in the data. So I'm going to have two very small remarks about this. The first would be about the model itself and what the data can identify and how much you can extrapolate from a model like this. And the second will concern how well the paper will reach the objectives that are stipulated in the paper. And it's both minor things. I will leave other things for the discussion afterwards, I think. So this is the Keynesian cross again. I'm just pulling up the same equations as we had before. And this is sort of related to the model. I've been working a lot on these things myself in slightly different frameworks. It's not that different. But government spending up means that S goes up. So increasing government spending means that the government must borrow given a certain amount of taxes, it means the savings must increase in order for government to spend this money. And some people would argue that that implies that consumption goes down. If households are going to save more, they need to consume less. And that's just an identity. Now, it is both are equally valid within these three equations. There's nothing in these three equations that singles out what actually is going to happen when the government starts to borrow. So Robert Barrow would, for instance, say a dollar spent by the government is a dollar borrowed by the government, which must be a dollar less spent by someone else. And that's exactly what I'm saying here, that if you want individuals, if the government must borrow, someone must save, and when someone saves, that person is consuming less. Now, I'm not saying that is the relevant argument, but I'm saying that some people would put forward that argument, and there's nothing in the framework itself or in the data that can in any way identify or invalidate that logic. Given an example, savings can depend on the interest rate, so suppose S here is positively related to the interest rate. If I increase G, I know that the interest rate must increase, and then consumption will fall, and you're going to have a multiplier of zero, and it's going to be perfect crowding out. It is a perfectly nested, it's a logic that is nested in these three equations. But the behavioral assumptions in this article and in textbook articles are imposed assumptions. They are not informed by the data itself. So we know there will always be a ratio between consumption and output in any economy, and it's going to be positive. It doesn't mean there's a causal relationship established. So the exercise here, I think, actually resembles a Kidlin and Prescott-style exercise. You take a model, you treat it as the literal truth, and then you put numbers to the parameters and you show what it implies. I think it's a fine exercise, but it's only valid as long as the model is valid. So all these numbers make sense within the realm of the model, but not outside of the model. So only if we believe this model represents the truth will these numbers actually have a meaning. I'm very sympathetic to the model. I said in my first slide, I love the model, but there can be other perspectives as well. Another thing, and this is a little bit taken out of context, is that one of the questions that are being addressed, and this is related to, I believe, my second remark, is that a lot of the VER frameworks, the econometric frameworks that has been used, they do use a linear structure. And the linear structure normally means that all the effects are going to be symmetric, up or down, recessions or expansions. That's definitely true. I'm not convinced that this framework is immune to that type of criticism. The model is linear, which means that every effect upwards is going to be with the same magnitude downwards, but with a negative sign on it. It also means that I personally believe that expansionary government spending may have a positive impact on the economy, but I'm also very convinced that contractions will hurt the economy more than expansions can benefit the economy. Essentially, the reason I would say that is because I think we spoke about slackness in the economy. I think if you want to increase output by spending, you need to target sectors that experience slack, and it's not easy. Not all sectors simultaneously exhibit slack. But once you cut spending, you make sure to cut spending everywhere, and you're going to make sure to contract output everywhere. I also think this is a model which is a crisis model. I think the model assumes that we're always in economic slack. So the ISLM model is a model it's depression economics. It's a model, there's no way of making a distinction in the model when there is slack and when there is no slack. So I think when you make these calculations, you assume there is slack in each and every year. And of course, I mean, one thing that maybe this criticism is a little bit unfair. The multiplier is calculated to be lower in the crisis year of 2007. Of course, the crisis only emerged very late in 2007. But I find it hard to argue that the years of 2002 to 2006 were years of tremendous economic slack. Rather, I think many people, at least in hindsight, would say the economy was sort of overheating. And maybe there was even, you know, asset pricing bubbles expanding. I don't think an increase in government spending would do much to growth during those years. And again, this is not the data speaking; it's the model speaking with imposed numbers. my final remark here would be that. All behavioral assumptions is of the type, and I just took consumption here as an example, that you have aggregate consumption is a fraction of output. This means that behavior is permitted to change over time, and this is what we saw. We saw different multipliers in different years, and that's related to these propensities changing. But they are not allowed, so behavior is allowed to change over time in any way it wishes, what the data says, but it's not allowed to change with respect to policy. So the fact that we embark on expansionary policy or austerity doesn't change behavior with a given year. That behavior is given. The only thing that can change is behavior over time. So behavior changes. My view would be the other way around, that time is less important than the economic environment. So when policy changes, we change the economic environment. I would believe that's more important for behavioral changes than time itself. That's it. I have no further remarks.